Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
In the book of Joel today, it's a very interesting book, but it's caused a great consternation among commentators because they can't put it in a historical setting. So we will try to look at it a minute and see what we can affirm without being too dogmatic, because the great commentators of the past have disagreed tremendously. His name means Yahweh is El, or the Lord is God, something like that. It's a title that shows respect of his parents. It's a title that shows the Yahwistic faith in which he was brought up. There are about 13 different people from Samuel to Nehemiah named Joel, but only in this book is this particular Joel talked about. Now, I always get stuck on this name. Epiphanus says that he is from the tribe of Reuben, but that really comes from a misunderstanding of 1 Chronicles 5:4. It seems that he is a resident of Jerusalem. Some say he's a cultic prophet, which may be very true, because he understands not only the geographical area around the city of Jerusalem, but understands the priestly ritual very much and calls for that. This prophet is very cultus-centered. He's not a universal prophet like Isaiah. He's very cultus-centered, very Israel-centered. And in the context, you'll see why he is that way. Now, as for date, there have been so many proposals, it's hard to be specific. Here are some of the possibilities. During the reign of Uzziah, during the reign of Josiah, during the late pre-exilic period, during the reign of Zedekiah, during the early post-exilic period, during the late post-exilic period, a futuristic eschatology with no specific historical setting. And that's what Kyle said. Now, my particular view is that it relates somewhere to the early post-exilic period. And I think that fits my understanding. But here are the basic criteria on which I base that. Obviously, I'm assuming that Amos 1:2 and Isaiah 13:6 is quoted by Joel. Now, others say that Amos and Isaiah quote Joel, but I think Joel quotes them. Judah is called Israel, chapter 2, verse 27, chapter 3, verse 1 and 2, and chapter 3, 16. That shows me early post-exilic. The mention of the Greek traders in chapter 3, verse 6. The mention of the Sabians in chapter 3, verse 8. The reference to the Philistines and the Phoenicians, chapter 3, verse 4. The mention of Edom in 3:19 must predate their fall, mentioned in Malachi 1, 3 and 4. The mention of the invasion in chapter 3, 2, I think refers to Nebuchadnezzar in 586 B.C., destroying the temple. I think that Joel 2:32 seems to be an allusion to Obadiah 17, and if so, Joel, along with Obadiah, must be early, pre-exilic. Now, Calvin has said, and by the way, this is one of my favorite commentaries on this, it's called the New International Commentary Series. Wherever I can find this, I just really appreciate it. Alan quotes John Calvin about the authorship and date of this book, and I wanted to quote that. Here's John Calvin. As there is no certainty, it is better to leave the time in which he taught undecided. And we shall see that it is no great importance. Not to know the time of Hosea would be to the readers a great loss, for there are many parts which could not be explained without a knowledge of the history. But as to Joel, there is less need of this, for the import of his doctrine is evident, though his time is obscure and uncertain. Well, I like John Calvin. While I'm at it, another good book, I think, is The Minor Prophets, and it's put out by Concordia, and the author is Dr. Theo Laetsch, and it's very helpful. It's going to say that Joel is speaking about the church. And right up front, I want to admit to you, I have some tensions in my own life here. I am not sure if all the prophecies are going to be literally fulfilled to Israel, or if the church has taken over the responsibilities of Israel. I guess I'm somewhere in the middle of that, because I do believe that God's going to keep his word, and he's going to do some things for national Israel because he promised them. Not because they deserve it, but because he promised them. And I think Romans 9 through 11 is something of that. Yet at the same time, it seems to me that some of the parables of Jesus, particularly the wicked tenants, shows that God has cut off, if not Israel, the leaders of Israel, from being his instrument of redemption, and has put the church in its place. I am not dispensational pre. I am more historical pre. But I do still struggle with eschatological prophecies like Joel that focus into a very Jewishness. In my opinion, it's very unfortunate to make Revelation a very Jewish book. I think God has fulfilled his promises to the world, to the church. I don't see the church as a competitor to Israel. I see her as a companion, a supplementer, a fulfiller of the promises. And so you'll have to struggle with that yourself, and it's not an easy thing to do. The position of this book in the Minor Prophets has suggested to many, including rabbinical tradition, that the book of Joel is very early. And yet you really can't base a whole lot on that, even though some great early Christian commentators did. Now, is the locust invasion that come, is it symbolic? Is it literal? Is it eschatological? Well, there are several views of this, and I will get to that when I come to chapter 1. Basically, the book breaks into two halves. God coming into Judah in a locust plague to show his people they've gotten away from him is chapter 1, verse 2, through chapter 2, verse 17. And then God's great promise to restore his people in the midst of their persecution by foreign nations is chapter 2:18 through 3:21. And I think it's eschatological because, of course, this is what Peter quoted out of chapter 2 on Pentecost. And the little phrase, the day of the Lord, in my opinion, makes it eschatological. Now, the Hebrew text is going to have four chapters, but the English text only has three. For those of you who can possibly get it or possibly have access to it, the National Geographic magazine of December 1st, 1915, has an account of a locust plague in Palestine that really helps see some of the literary details that the prophet is speaking about. So with that in mind, let's go to the text if we could, okay? Chapter 1. The word of the Lord came to Joel, son of Pithuel. Now, the word of the Lord came to Joel. It's obvious that this is not the prophet had a bad dream. It's not that he ate Mexican food too late, you know, and had visions. But God's showing him the truth through this historical event. Now, it is quite common in the Old Testament for God to show futuristic truth through current historical crisis. That's why the Old Testament's so hard to interpret prophetically, because of this foreshadowing, this multiple fulfillment. And yet I think it's very true. Now, the prophet Joel, as I told you, means Lord is God, or Yahweh is El. Some say it means whose God is Yahweh, and either one is possible. It is very similar in meaning to the name Elijah. Mm-hmm. Now, he's the son of Pithuel. Now, the Septuagint and the Peshitta say Bethuel, but it seems to be a misunderstanding of the name, and they're trying to link it back to Rebekah's father in Genesis 22:22 and 23, but I think there's no connection there whatsoever. Now, in verse 2, we have a common prophetic introduction, two imperatives followed by a rhetorical question. We see the same structure in Isaiah 1:10 and 11, and Isaiah 28:23 through 25. Now, here they are. Hear and listen, and then the rhetorical question. That says, hear this, O elders. Now, King James has older men. There's always a problem between the Bible, between does elder mean a position in the community or simply an older man? The same tension can be seen clearly in 1 Timothy. Here, I think, it's probably talking about elders or leaders of the community. Now, notice where it mentions that this locust plague was so bad that there was no historical precedent for it at all. No one had heard about it, and they were to pass it on to their children because it had religious connotations. Now, beginning in verse 4. What the gnawing locust has left, the swarming locust has eaten. What the swarming locust has left, the creeping locust has eaten. What the creeping locust has left, the stripping locust has eaten. There's been much discussion here. What is this talking about? Is this descriptive of different stages in the life of a locust? A parent locust comes in, lays eggs, then the larva comes out, another parent locust. Is that what it is, stages in development? Or is it successive invasions, wave after wave? Or is it four different species of locusts? Well, I think from the text that we're talking about an invasion wave after wave, just put in different literary intensification. But there's been a lot of confusion over that. Now, the question has come, is this literal, symbolic, or eschatological? Well, obviously, the description here is very, very literal. And it fits tremendously that the National Geographic invasion That invasion even came from the northeast, just like this one comes from the north. It usually came from the southwest, so it's a different one. But it seems that it's very accurate in its description, not only of the animals, but in their practices when they come in such large numbers. It is obvious that it may have a symbolic nature, because in Amos chapter 7, verses 1 through 3, and Revelation 9, 3 through 10 or 11, locusts are used in a symbolic way. But some have taken that locust in Revelation 9 and used it to be an eschatological setting because of the day of the Lord mentioned and all of that. It may be. I personally think it's not symbolic. It's a literal invasion of locusts used as an example of the end time events. And that's pretty much where my theology goes. Now, I want to say to you that this curse of locusts goes back to what has been so pivotal in my understanding of the Old Testament. God said, if you keep my covenant, I'll bless you. And I'll bless you tremendously agriculturally, and the fertility of your children. You'll have peace. You'll have prosperity. You'll have dancing and festivals. But if you break my covenant, I'll curse you. And this curse of locusts is part of the Deuteronomy 27 and 28 pattern, particularly Deuteronomy 28:38, and you might want to see that. Now, beginning in verses 5 down through about 14, or I think some commentators say three groups, but I think four groups of people addressed that should be appalled at what's happening in their country and called a spiritual fast and prayer meeting to ask God to forgive their sins and to take away this plague. Now, the first group, I think, is found in verse 5 through 7, where we have these drunkards. And then in verses 8 and 9, we have, because the verbal forms are feminine imperative singular, I think it's the nation of Israel personified as the virgin daughter of Zion. And then in verse 11 and 12, we have the agriculturalist of the community. And then in verses 13 and 14, we have the priests. Now, the priests are mentioned in verse 9, but they're focused in verse 13 and 14. Now, let's look for a minute. Awake, drunkards, and weep and wail, all you wine drinkers. Now, the problem here is that the locusts are going to take everything. There's not going to be any wine for these guys to drink. And, boy, that's going to cause great destruction. Now, I want to say to you that from Psalms 104:15, wine is a gift from God that gladdens the hearts of men. It is a gift for men. Therefore, these men are to see the spiritual nature of their gift being taken away and are to supplicate God to bring it back. Now, what it mentions on account of sweet wine, there are many folks who try to make sweet wine non-alcoholic. But this particular verse, linking sweet wine to drunkards, and Isaiah 49:26 shows that sweet wine was alcoholic. I have a tape I've done on alcoholism in the Bible that I did for a regional seminar for Alcohol Anonymous, and I'd be more than happy to make that available to you if you're right. I think I'll surprise you on what I say, but I think it's a thoughtful biblical approach instead of a cultural approach that's all too often what we do in the area of this. Now, notice in verse 6 it says, "For a nation has invaded my land." Now, the military description of the allusion of the locusts as an army is found in chapter 2, verses 4 through 11, and here's the allusion here of the word invaded. Now, the word invaded means to come against, and that's used for a military invasion in Judges 6:3 and 1 Kings 14:25. Okay? Now, it describes them as lions. Notice where God says, "My vine, my fig tree." You see, agricultural produce and bounty was a gift from Yahweh, Hosea 2, 8 and 9. Notice where it says their branches become white. This is simply an accurate metaphor of when the locusts get through with eating the tips off the trees or the bushes, then the sun comes and bakes that. It's already exposed cellulose material. It turns white. So it's an accurate description here of a locust invasion. Now in verse 8, "Wail like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the bridegroom of her youth." Now what is that talking about? Well, because they are a feminine singular imperatives, I think it's allusion to the whole people of God addressed as Zion or Jerusalem. Now, the particular allusion here is a betrothed woman whose husband has died. Now, remember, you see in Mary and Joseph how strong betrothal was. Matter of fact, there is such a thing in an Old Testament as a virgin widow, which means this betrothal period, if the husband died, the woman was still considered a widow, even though the marriage had not been consummated. And this seems to be an allusion here. It's one of the worst kind of sorrows possible, along with the death of an only son. Notice where it says, "The grain offerings and the libations are cut off from the house of the Lord. The priest mourns." Now, these libations or grain offerings were according to the regular sacrifice. Basically, there was a sacrifice in the morning and a sacrifice in the evening. It was a lamb. Now, along with this lamb was a meal offering wet with oil and a wine libation poured out on the altar. Well, that had to cease because there wasn't enough. There wasn't any meal, there wasn't any oil, there wasn't any wine, and the lambs were even dying. And so that's the idea here. Now, in verse 11, the farmers and the vine dressers are addressed because the harvest has failed. Wheat and barley, two major crops. Wheat, the bread for the richer folks. Barley, the bread for the poorer folks. It was all gone. Even their, if I could put a metaphor, their seed corn was gone because they planted the crops with what they were planning to, their seed crop from last year, and now everything was gone. No seed crop, no food. It was a real, real serious problem. Serious to the extent the community could be wiped out from hunger because there was no network of trade and no network of relief. They were just going to die. Now, in verse 13, it mentions the priests, the ministers of the altar, and the ministers of God. They're dressed in sackcloth. They are to have a special prayer meeting, fast. This shows the religious nature of the locust feast. This is the view that nothing just happens to God's children, and agricultural problems were related to God's anger against his people. See Deuteronomy 27 and 28. Now, in verse 14, it says, consecrate a fast, proclaim a solemn assembly. Now, here we have this very unusual thing in the sense of Western minds, but very usual in the sense of Jewish minds. There were several fast feast days and during the year, one fast day, Leviticus 16. But for a national emergency, a special fast day could be called. We see some of them in Judges 20, verse 26, 1 Samuel 3, 5 and 6, 1 Kings 8, 33 and 34, and Jeremiah 14 are some of the examples of these special called fast days. Notice where it says in verse 15, alas for the day. Now, there are two allusions to this. It refers to an eschatological sense, where the people are to cry and out to God. You might want to see Ezekiel 30, verses 2 and 3, and Isaiah 13, 6. Now, the second line is the very important one. For the day of the Lord is near. Now, that's the theme of chapter 3, the day of the Lord. It's an eschatological theme repeated so often in the prophets. Many think it occurred first in Amos, but I'm going to give you the order of their occurrences from the biblical books. Isaiah 2, 12, Isaiah 13, 6 and 9, Isaiah 22, 5, Isaiah 34, 8, Jeremiah 46, 10, Ezekiel 7, 10, 13, 5, 30, verse 3, Amos 5, 18 through 20, Zephaniah 1, 7, Zephaniah 1, 14 through 18, Obadiah 15, and Zechariah 14, 1. The day of the Lord is a common eschatological metaphor. Matter of fact, the setting of chapter 3 is the eschatological event of chapter 2, I think, is where we're going to see it pick up very clearly when we see the day of the Lord. It's going to be quoted by Peter at Pentecost. Okay? Now, notice the next line, the third line of verse 15. And it will come as destruction from the Almighty. Now, the word Almighty is the word El Shaddai. We're not exactly sure of the etymology of Shaddai. It doesn't seem to be Hebrew. But the Septuagint and the Vulgate say that it means omnipotence. So we usually translate it Almighty. Now, there's a play in the Hebrew word. The word destruction is mighty ruins is the Hebrew word S-H-O-D. The word Almighty is the word S-H-A-D-D-A-Y. The Hebrews would have picked up on that. Now, God is the Almighty. That's the patriarchal name for God. That's what Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob called God. The word Yahweh was not revealed until Moses, Exodus 3:14. So here is the patriarchal protector of the people of God, but now he's linked to the word destruction. You mean that God, the Almighty Protector, has become the destroyer? Well, that is the import of chapter 1 because there's been a theological breaking of the covenant and God has reacted. This is the discipline of Hebrews 12, 5 and following, that God would not let his people get away without trying to bring them back through discipline. In the Old Testament, it's agricultural, physical. Many times in the New, it's a spiritual restraint or problem that we face. Now, let's see, in verse 17 is very, very hard to translate. Let's see, I have my, well, I didn't bring it over here. There is a book called The 26 Translations of the Old Testament that's recently been put out by AMG in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It's been out for a long time in New Testament. The editor is Curtis Vaughn. It is very important in verses like 17 to get as many other translations as possible. Because there are three words in verse 17 that only appear in this verse in all the Old Testament. Our knowledge of ancient Hebrew is very limited. We don't have many other documents. And so it's really a problem on how do you translate verse 17. It is obvious that it is an agricultural sense, but exactly what you can see from the multiplicity of English translations. Okay? Let's see. Verse 18, notice that the beast groan. And then it says, the herds of cattle wander aimlessly. You know, I really think God cares about physical creation. I see him making creation and saying it was good, and finally in Genesis 1:31, it's very good. I see him in the book of Job, I believe, saying he plays with Leviathan. God cares about the animals. So the prophet here, reflecting God's word, says the animals are groaning, and I've heard about that. Now, we might want to see Romans 8, 18 through 22, where all creation groans because of the sin of man, and all creation will again be redeemed by man. Here the animals are hurt, and God takes notice of that through the prophets, okay? Now, often in verse 18, there seems to be a drought involved. Now, there's a very common historical link between droughts and locust plagues. Maybe the drought forces the locusts to move from where they were to another area. But here we have drought and locusts coming together, all right? Everything's dried up, and what's not dried up is eaten. Verse 19, to thee, O Lord, I cry. The prophet has set the stage in verse 13 and 14 for the people to be called together. All the elements of society are called together for a special fast day. And then in verses 19 and 20, he gives them the pattern by which they are to pray unto God. Notice it says, O Lord, this is the covenant name for God, Yahweh, YHWH, from the Hebrew verb to be. We see it first in Exodus 3:14. Now, I know it's used in Genesis, and it's used in other places. You can tell it because it's all caps. If you want to see both of the words translated Lord, look at Psalms 110, where it says, My Lord said to the Lord, and you'll see one Lord has a capital L, but little O-R-D, and the other one has all caps. That's Adonai, which means husband, master, owner. Now, the idea here, I think, is the ever-living, only-living God is the metaphor. For fire has devoured the pastures of the wilderness, and the flames has burned up the trees of the fields. Now, this is a lament poetic structure. It's like a funeral dirge. This fire here may be a metaphor of destruction, or it may be the idea of the drought that came, or it may be the red on the locust body. Now, in chapter 2, it's going to talk about the dawn. Well, many think, and we've reported that the red on the species of some locust, when the light hits it, turns the whole sky to red. So maybe it's a metaphor of the flame of the color of these locusts as they come in such great numbers, and we're not sure. Notice verse 20 where it says, even the beasts of the field pant for thee. You might want to see Psalms 42:1, where panting is used in a religious sense. My soul pants for thee as a hart pants after the water brook. Now, here's the idea of physical pressure. And you know what kind of tremendous physical desire lack of water brings. Well, that's the idea here. Now, I think the metaphor may be we need to seek God like that. That's what Psalms 42:1 is all about. This whole chapter is the historical invasion of locusts. And the prophet's mind sees that covenant relationship of Deuteronomy 27 and 28. He says God wouldn't send this unless we've sinned. We need to pray and ask God to forgive us, and God will take it away. Now, several things are important here. God's in control of history. He's in control of nations. He's in control of nature. Nothing just happens to the people of God. The evil things in the Old Testament are seen as punishments. Now, I want to make a New Testament application. It is true that many times the things that come in our lives are temporal punishments. But for the most part, at least in this the New Testament, punishment is reserved primarily for an eschatological setting. Now, I know that when we sin, we reap the consequences of sin in this life. We don't break God's laws. We break ourselves on God's law. So I know that sin always runs its course and we pay a price. But this supernatural judgment, I think, still occurs, but for a purpose of redeeming the people of God. So now, when problems come in our life, it could be spiritual, yes, and we need to pray and repent. It could be because we're caught up in a fallen, sinful world, and the rain falls on the just and the unjust, and so do the plagues, so do the locusts. And it may be a fact that God is trying to teach us something through the problems we go through as Jesus suffered and was matured by the things he suffered, Hebrews 5:8. So there are many reasons for this, but the prophet in his setting sees God's hand. And he sees God's hand historically, and he sees God's hand because of chapter 2 and 3 in the future. And so, in the next few chapters, this is going to reflect the military invasion of God's people. So God tried agriculturally to turn his people to him, and what they did, they prayed to Baal instead of to him. God help us. That's where you ought to see that Hosea 2, 8 and 9 passage. They were praying to Baal instead of Yahweh to thank Baal for the agricultural blessings. It was God that did it. And because they did that, he finally had to send pagan armies, first Assyria, then Neo-Babylon. Surrounding nations were enemies, to bring his people away from ritual back to personal relationship. And that is the stage going to be set for Joel. Now, I know Joel is very nationalistic-centered, but let's don't judge him in light of our day. Let's judge him in light of his day. He was expressing that deep covenant relationship between God and his people. Apparently, he did not see or did not choose to respond to the implications of the Gentiles being included in the covenant. That will come later. So let's just let him speak for what he will, and I think we'll understand his prophet much better. I hope you'll get the two commentaries and other books you may have, though there are no real good commentaries on Joel. I think the New International is the best. I've enjoyed being with you, and I hope you have a good day. Good luck in this little minor prophet. It'll take some effort, but there's a great blessing here. God bless you. Have a good day.